Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Fernando. Stay away from burning down my master's house.
Scott.
Oh, my name is Jim. I think Seymour Hersh writing in the New York magazine is making more sense about the mess in the world today than most people.
Carl.
Snake, I enjoyed the walk here this morning.
I'm Roger, and I returned recently from India, where I saw Julius Caesar in Hindi. Now I'm reading it in English.
Ed, and I recently here to find a concert by the Christian class.
And
appreciated coming home. Been away for a while.
We're very fortunate today to have Brooke, who is the head of practice at the Green Gulch Zen Center. She's been with the San Francisco Zen Center since 76 and was ordained in 86. So, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. Good morning. As always, I find myself wondering what to talk about. There are so many things to talk about. And just listening to each of you name a book or a movie or a place or a season, I thought, well, how can we ever begin? How can we ever end? So, fortunately for you, I brought some notes. So... maybe get too out of control. Recently I was asked to participate in a panel to discuss a film that I would guess most of you haven't seen, but I could be wrong, The Passion of the Christ. Has anyone seen it? Yeah. Well, good. I can say anything. this has been common experience. I was invited to be on this panel with a Catholic priest, a Jewish woman rabbi, and me. And I said to the moderator, am I the referee? he said... we're trying not to think like that. But yes, yeah. As a matter of fact, they put me between the gentleman and the lady. So I want to use the film, which you haven't seen, as a kind of touchstone for what I want to say about very basic teaching of the Buddha called the Three Pure Precepts. And as I was driving over here, I was trying to think of a metaphor for the precepts that might work for you. And I'm not computer literate. I can do email, and that's about it, and word processing. But I thought in terms of a computer, that the screensaver in Buddhism we might think of as being absolutely nothing at all. Not a computer, not a computer operator. Not a screensaver. Absolutely nothing at all. And that's saying too much. However, kind of like a CD-ROM, if someone from left field were to come in and push a button for you so that you could actually see the computer and begin the program of being alive, what you would see is called dualistic opinions and views. You would see what in Buddhism is called non-duality, which is a word to help us understand how dualistic we are. And when that vision arrives, you would see the computer, and you would believe yourself to be sitting in a chair looking at the computer, which is what we call our usual experience of reality. It's dualistic. It appears as two things. One thing is you, or me, in my case. And the other thing is everything else. And this is the fundamental affliction of ignorance that the Buddha said is the cause of our suffering. We believe that this appearance of two things is true. And we act on that appearance in a variety of ways, and those ways are basically reported in the chronicle every day. We lie, we kill, we steal, we intoxicate, we slander, we're possessive, we sexualize, we are angry. Everything you know about the world is a result of this particular impression that there are two things, yourself and everything else. And most of what we do is try to strategize how to maximize protection and security for the one. And then we have relationships with the other that will bring about that end. This is what the Buddha said. And this is what we study as Buddhists, is how is that so? Is that so? Am I willing to look closely at what I presume to be reality? I've started thinking of reality lately. It's been very helpful as kind of, my name is useful, Fu, because it goes with the Fu review of reality. It's kind of like this journal that I'm writing continuously. The Fu review of reality. What do I think is happening now? What do I think is happening now? And do I believe it? And we tend to believe it, just as a matter of course. Our tendency is to believe our review of reality. And this is the beginning of practice, is the beginning of doubting our review of reality. Is that so? There's a story that my teacher likes to tell that was kind of an entry point for him. I think you've all heard of koans, or it means a public case. I've recently been reading the DSM-3, which is a kind of public case of various ways that we all can be confused or lopsided in our behaviors. It's all about behavior. When we're all sitting here together, did you notice how perfect everyone is? You were all perfect during my meditation. And I was keeping my eyes open so that I can include you in my experience. And none of you, I loved the phones, and people moving and breathing. It was all just fine. It's actually just fine the way it is. But then we shift. That's not our only channel, just fine the way it is. That's a rather wonderful channel. It's one reason we meditate, is so we can have an experience of things being just fine the way they are. So, where was I going? I knew this would happen. Thank you, the DSM-3. Thank you. So, public case, a koan. The DSM is a kind of public case. These are cases. And the book I have is Case Histories and Recommended Treatment for various cases. So koans are basically cases. Here's a situation of how someone thought a certain way. And here's what the teacher, or therapist, or priest, or your mother, or whoever, said about what you thought in response. And then here's your response to the response, and so on. So koans are really basically just little slices of a corrective that was given by a teacher to a student, and in some cases, a teacher meeting a teacher. So there's no corrective. It's more like bam, 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 bam. Wonderful little handball game or something like that. So I want to use some koans in talking this morning as ways of helping to explain these elements of Passion of Christ that I think are relevant for us as Buddhists or as humans. And the first teaching I want to offer you comes from Master Dogen, who's the founder of the Zen traditional, the tradition that I'm part of, Sopo Zen, Japanese master. And his koan for us is that the entire universe in the 10 directions is the true human body. The entire universe in the 10 directions is the true human body. So this is a statement by Master Dogen of the review, Dogen's review of reality. That's what he sees. And he lines himself up with Shakyamuni Buddha. This is what Shakyamuni Buddha saw. the morning of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, he looked up at the sky, he saw a star, and he saw himself, complete. No me and everything else. No me, no everything else. Just one human body. Even that's saying too much. So, one of the mechanisms for connecting us with reality is what we call, for lack of other words, love. You know, love is the word we use when we say, I feel great, I feel connected, I feel happy with my friends and my life. You know, this is, I'm having a lovely day. It's a lovely day. So love is the human connector. It's what connected the star to the Buddha. He loved himself, he loved the sky, he loved the star, he loved the birds, he loved the tree. He was in love with the one body, 10 directions, the true human body. Hatred is obviously the opposite. It's what cuts us off. Like walls, steel walls going up all around. There's a New Yorker cartoon of this guy in prison. He's got these bars and he's holding on, looking out. But behind him, it's open. So this is our mind that sees trapped bars. It's a mental phenomenon. And what the Buddha taught is, as I say to my daughter very often, the problem is not with the cookie, it's with your noodle. It's in your mind. But she tells me not to give her that Buddhist stuff. But maybe you're willing, I don't know, to hear some Buddhist stuff. You know, it's in your mind. It's in your mind. That's where your problems are. It's not your neighbors, it's not your car, it's not your lover, it's not your food, it's not the waiter, you know, it's your mind. And this is the painful part, is actually beginning to accept. And it's not your fault, I should add that. It's not your fault that your mind is doing this. It's nobody's fault. It's the way all of our minds They work in this very fundamental way. This fundamental illusion of ignorance is an illusion that comes to us very naturally. It's our inheritance. By being born, the universe, in order to turn back and look at itself, had to separate itself into two things. Here's this wonderful creation. Right? So the universe is going to look back, and what does it see? Two things. It doesn't see unity. See separation. In order to see, you have to have an object and a subject. So it's kind of like, it's a problem, it's a koan, it's a public case, it's all of our public case, but it can be solved through wisdom, through understanding, and through sitting in the middle of yourself quietly and peacefully. When you actually can see the entire universe in the 10 directions is the one true human body. By seeing that, by knowing that, through your experience in meditation, it's easier when it's not so obvious. You can remember, oh yeah, I'm getting confused. My anger is confusion. My jealousy is confusion. My greed is confusion. My confusion is confusion. So, This sentence I've been repeating, the entire universe, 10 directions, true human body, embedded in this quote by Mr. Dogen are the two principles of Buddhist philosophy. The first principle, the ultimate truth, and the second principle, which is the conventional truth or the relative truth. So the entire universe, 10 directions, true human body, we can say represents a statement about the ultimate truth. It's the ultimate truth is ineffable, meaning cannot be said. It is beyond our grasp. It's beyond our knowledge. We cannot know it, but we are it. We can be it. We are it. We can't not be it. It's what we are. But we can't get a hold of it. We can't say it. The words won't get it. So I just said it, though, didn't I? The entire universe in the 10 directions is the true human body. So what I said is conventional truth. It's in words. So this kind of statement or koan or talking, the talking that we do, Dharma talking, is called the finger that points at the moon. We use language, we use words to point at ultimate principle. But the words will never touch it. Words can't ever get it. You know, I'm pointing at it right now. It doesn't come close. I'll never know what this is. You'll never know what you are. But you are it. No problem. Morning, noon, and night. Piece of cake. But we can't say it right. We can't get it right. We can't think it right. But we struggle all the time trying to get a hold of it. So these two principles, ultimate principle, what we are, and secondary principle, or conventional truth, is trying to talk about what we are, trying to understand what we are. And this is the Buddha's teaching, finger pointing at the moon. There's a saying, another koan, the Buddha never said a single word. Never spoke a word. So, next card. So our training as meditators, as in my particular school, Zen school, is to come to understand this distinction between our ability to know and our being, our life of being. So a lot of our work in the community, when young people come to Zen Center, you know, they want the ultimate truth. They're very sincere, and they're wonderfully sincere, and they're beautifully sincere, and they're doing all kinds of things that are really problematic. Like a lot of them have been doing a lot of drugs. They've been running around and doing various, you know, kind of mysterious behaviors, and they're so sincere and energetic. So what we do is put them in the kitchen and give them a knife and a bag of carrots. Okay, now Zen training is beginning. Please make all the carrots just this size. And we put a toothpick in the sample and set it there on the table. And we need them in 20 minutes. No, they're getting too big. You have to make them that size. Pretty soon the beast starts to quiet down, little by little, week after week, stacks of dishes getting cleaned, mountains of carrots getting chopped. We have fields of lettuce to hoe, we have all kinds of wonderful mechanisms for helping people to calm down. This is step one. Buddhism is a two-step, basically. It's two simple steps, although each of them take quite a while to master, like any craft. First step is called shamatha, or tranquility. This is the practice of meditation that you all were doing this morning. It's challenging, you know. We all sat down. I was still panicked about not being able to find a place to park. I drove in. There were lots of places to park. I got out. The meter said 1 hour. I didn't read the whole meter. So I got back in my car. I drove around the block. And I thought, wait a minute, it said Monday through Saturday. Today's Sunday. Oh, God, idiot. So I drove around the block, came back over here. There weren't any longer any lots of places to park. There was one place to park. I was very glad. So I thought, and I was kind of in that state of being in when I came in here. So it took me quite a while to get out of it, to stop, drop it. Get it. It's okay. You made it. You're not late. I hate to be late. So this meditation, first step, shamatha, calm down. Quiet your mind. You can't quiet your mind, actually. You have to let your mind quiet. It's like a glass of dirty water. If you set it down, it will settle. So if you sit down long enough, you know, Stalin can testify, by the end of a week, you can settle your mind. It takes a while, but everybody's mind settles eventually. I've never seen anyone not settle. It just really happens for you. And it's a wonderful relief. Particularly if you've never experienced yourself that way, which is not uncommon. Most people don't. You're not invited to settle down very many places. Maybe in front of a TV. But you're kind of in a trance. And as long as the TV's on, it works. But you know, turn it off and you can stare for a while, but you'll get bored. So learning to calm your mind, how to put yourself in a situation where your mind will be calm, so that then step two is called vipassana, which means insight. So first calm the mind, and then look at reality. You can't see reality with an agitated mind. It just looks agitated. It's all you can see. It looks angry, or it looks greedy. It's the dye in front of your awareness. So you have to clear your awareness in order to look at reality. And then when you look, you won't see anything at all. So I wanted to bring up the precept. How many? What time is it?
We need to conclude at noon. We need about 5 minutes before that.
Okay.
Before that.
All right. Well, I'd like to also love to hear questions or comments, so I'll not go too much longer. So the precepts, my understanding of what the precepts are about is this fundamental reality, which is non-dual, is not separate. We are not separate from reality. Reality is of a whole. You can't divide it into parts. Concepts, however, thinking, looks like parts. Looks like parts. Chair. Find the chair. And you teach children how to find the parts of reality. Find the dog. Find the moon. You give them all the names of all the parts. And then we segment the world by language. And then we kind of get confused about the words versus the object. We think the words and the object are the same thing. Because thinging, interesting enough, if you look up the word think, the origin of the word think is the same as the word thing, tong, to tong. It's not a mistake. We make things by thinking them. That's how you get a thing. You have to extract something from the whole. It's by thinking. So thinking, you can imagine thinking is kind of like cardboard, writing on a piece of cardboard. He's a really nice guy. I like him. He's got blue eyes and blonde hair, and you fill out the whole card. Went to Stanford, too. So you get this card about the person, and you see the person, and it's very hard not to put the card on them. Schlep. There's my card. I stopped seeing the person. So I don't know you yet, so I can still see you. But if I start knowing something about you, then I'm going to get very tempted to make a card. And then I'll see the card. And I relate to the card. And I forget about the fuzzy reality that's lurking beneath the card, which is actually kind of nervous. It's kind of nervous not to know what's happening. So this is part of the problem. The trade-off between reality and conceptual thinking is reality is kind of nervous. There's anxiety there. This is what the Buddha taught, First Noble Truth. There is anxiety. Anxiety is caused by this delusional thinking that there are two things. If you think there are two things, there's anxiety. We do think there are two things. There's anxiety. You don't think there are two things, anxiety goes away behind the cardboard. But that's called dead. Concepts are dead. They already happened. They're gone. The thing they refer to isn't even there. And they have no referent except themselves. You can write novels and read them. It's okay. It's not a bad thing. But we've mistaken this thinking for reality. We get confused. So this is another basic teaching of the Buddha. There's a wonderful sutra called the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, meaning untying the knots. It's a very elaborate explanation of this phenomenon, of how we mistake reality for concepts about reality. And in this teaching, it is explained that every phenomena, meaning everything you know, every sight, every smell, every taste, every touch, every word, every phenomena has three qualities, three characteristics. One characteristic is called the imputational characteristic, which means what you think about it. Everything has a thought connected to it. You don't have a thing without a thought. So that's what makes it not so fuzzy. It's clear because you have a thought about it. Where's the candle? So we have a thought, things get clearer, sharper. So that's the imputational quality. We use that to sharpen up our relationship to the world. The second quality that everything has is it's dependently co-arisen. It just is here because of all the things that are allowing it to be here. The air in this room, the sunlight in the sky, the oxygen for the candle and the wax and the bees and the farmers and the children and the dogs and your glasses and your body. All of that together allows what we call a candle. It's so puny to say candle, right? Candle. But actually, it's like, wow. It's ineffable. It's a miracle. Everything's a miracle of infinite creation, representative of creation, totality of creation. Each of you is that. And we say Bob. Okay, so those are the two qualities. The imputational, what we call it, and what it actually is, which we can't possibly grasp with language. However, we put these two together and we look at things through the imputation. And we forget about the other way that they are. And this is called delusion. The third characteristic is to see these two are not the same thing. And that's called the thoroughly established character of all things. When you can see that candle and whew, are not the same, you're seeing truly, thoroughly. And this is liberative. Knowing that these two things are not connected is the first step for liberation. So this is very basic, important teaching of Buddhist philosophy. There's a whole school called Yogacara School, which has taken off on this particular text. So this is what the Buddha understood the night of his enlightenment. He was studying his thinking, he was studying his mind, and he was studying his mind's looking at reality. And there's a wonderful story, another teaching story. And the Buddha was sitting under the tree. Mara, the evil one, comes. It's too bad you didn't see the film because you know what I mean. In Mel Gibson's film, Mara, the evil one, the devil, is this rather attractive, shaved head female who has grubs coming out of her nose every once in a while. And they've shaved her eyebrows and she's pale faced and she's lurking with this leering grin around the crowd, edge of the crowd, as Jesus is carrying the cross. And he's been, as you heard, flayed mercilessly by the Romans at the behest of the Jewish hierarchy, according to Mr. Gibson's version of the Bible. And so the devil is depicted as, here's, you know, Mr. Gibson's first error, as external, as separate from the viewer, outside. Devil's outside. You, in fact, you can avoid the devil. You can get rid of the devil. You can get rid of evil. You can put it away. You can lock it up. You can kill it. Right? We think we can do that. We're building huge new prisons just to get rid of evil, right? So we're going to separate ourselves from evil. We're going to put it outside. That's what it looks like in this movie. He, she is outside. Another scene, Herod is depicted as a gay man. So it looks. He's acting in a way that one cartoon and a cartoon would like to depict gay men as acting. None of you are acting like that, but this is how Herod is. And he's very silly, and he's very... he's making fun of Jesus, telling him, like, come on, say something funnier. He's making fun of him. So it's very cartoony. I felt really angry when I was looking at this. I thought, this is so mean. Why is Mel Gibson being so mean? Well, because he's externalizing evil. He thinks it's outside. So that means things can be wrong. There can be wrong with people doing that or doing that. Sin is out there. It's not in the eye of the beholder. So he also has Jesus stepping on a snake's head. The devil sends a snake to tempt him away from his mission of being crucified. And Jesus, after sweating very profusely in the garden for a while, he stands up and he steps on this snake. And I thought, oh, this is terrible. I mean, a holy man wouldn't step on a snake, but he's shown doing this very cruel thing to an animal. So the whole feeling of the film is something we're familiar with. We've been seeing and hearing these kinds of stories all our lives. Evil's outside. And we can be separate from it. We can be good. We know who's bad. But the finger's pointing the wrong way. The finger's missing this point. Evil is not outside. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of projecting. It comes from inside, the projector. So when Mara comes to the Buddha, the Buddha's sitting under a tree, and he sees, in the depiction in the Buddhist stories as well, he's external. There's an evil one, Mara the evil one. He has a very fuzzy face, kind of dark, sinister face. And he tells the Buddha, if you don't get up from the tree and give up this quest of yours for liberation, I will destroy you. And then the Buddha doesn't move. So Mara sends an army of orcs and Balrogs and attacks the Buddha. And he feels these hits, but he doesn't move. And then Mara vanishes the army, and he says, all right, I'll bring my more powerful weapons. So he sends these dancing girls and boys in to entertain the Buddha. Please get up from your chair. And again, the Buddha doesn't move. So again, Mara vanishes the vision. And then this time, Mara becomes visible in the clearing. Maybe you saw that movie, right? The little Buddha? Anyway, so then there's Mara in the clearing. And Mara says, now I will destroy you. And Buddha says, no, you won't, because I know who you are. And Mara says, you don't know who I am. And Buddha says, yes, I do. I know who you are. And Mara gets very nervous. And Buddha says, you are myself. And Mara vanishes. And then there's the Buddha under a tree in the forest. Little birds are twittering. Snakes are going by. So this is the Buddha's teaching, is that the evil one is lodged inside of our hearts. It's right inside. It's how we see. So the precepts, there's really just one precept, which is about self and other. That if you think there's something outside, you will even if you do it gently. You'll break the precepts. If you understand that there's nothing outside, the precepts are maintained by themselves. It's just natural. You wouldn't kill yourself. You wouldn't steal your things. You wouldn't lie to yourself. So it's a natural thing, these precepts. It's just the way it is when you don't think that someone's coming to get you. When you let go of the prison bars and turn around and walk out. So you don't have to keep the precepts. They're not rules. You don't have to follow them or learn them or anything else. But you can notice how they function in your life as you're feeling more of a peace, more whole. The three pure precepts which summarize that are called, basically, it's the training for that realization. And they are to avoid evil, do good, and save all beings. So avoiding evil is this realization that evil is not outside. Avoiding evil is learning where is evil, where is it, finding it, and making peace with that. Quieting your heart, shamatha, coming to peace. There is no evil when your heart is at peace. There is no evil anywhere. They can take your arms off, legs off. It doesn't matter. There is no evil. Death isn't evil. So this is step one, to find out what is evil and calm that, quiet that. And step two is to do all good, cultivate all good. So it's not enough for you to be okay. This is one of the temptations of the spiritual path, to get yours and then forget about everybody else. So there's a real inducement in the Mahayana tradition away from self-realization. Because self-realization would be dualistic. How can I get liberated and you not be, if you are me? So if you're suffering, I'm suffering. I don't get off this train until everyone gets off the train. That's the teaching. No one gets liberated without everybody else. You have to bring the whole of you with you. So that's the Buddha's teaching. Number three, save all beings means save all the beings that you are. Everyone is you. So everyone receives your great regard and your great compassion and your great effort to help to clarify whatever it is they need. If they're hungry, they get food. If they're confused, you try to give an explanation. Whatever you've got, you just give it as best you can. So the last teaching I wanted to mention is an exchange that happens in the film between Pilate and Jesus. Pilate's the Roman who has the power to crucify. And he is, in the film, he's getting his commandment to do this from the Jewish hierarchy. Now, of course, Jesus was a rabbi, which no one told me when I was a Christian child. So it's very important information. And he's Jewish. He's a young teacher, young rabbi, who has a good following. He was probably a political threat, which is why the Romans killed anybody, was because for political reasons, not spiritual reasons. They could care less. He had lots of gods. They didn't care about that part. But no political uprisings. And when the Jews finally did their last uprising, they threw him out. That's why they had to go on the road. The Romans threw the Jews out of Israel some years after Jesus' death. So this is a true story. It actually happened. They tore down the temple. The only thing left is the wall. This is where they're wailing for the loss of the temple. The temple is where Jesus went because he was a rabbi. And in the temple, there were blood sacrifices. Little lambs were sacrificed. Their blood was used to purify the people of their sins. This is the story. Jesus was the blood sacrifice offered by God to cleanse everyone with his blood. This is the story. It's a story from the Bible. And the Jewish and Christian stories are of a piece. It's one family story. And it's a terrible breach in the family. It's has been going on for thousands of years. So in the story of Jesus and Pilate, Pilate tells Jesus to come up to the top of the stairs where he's standing, and he says to Jesus, he has a little private interview with him, "Who are you?" He says, "Who are you?" And Jesus says, "I tell the truth." And this was the one moment in the movie where I was really interested. I thought, I mean, I was interested in all the rest of it, but in a kind of horrified way. But this moment was like, oh, what's the truth? And so Pilate says, "What is the truth?" And at that point, Mel Gibson cuts. Another scene. I'm like, wait a minute. They didn't let him say. And I thought, well, Mel Gibson doesn't know. And that's the main failing of the film. Mel Gibson doesn't know the truth. He's not a wisdom teacher. And he externalizes good and evil. So all of those flaws are in this film. All the lack of wisdom. So there's a parallel in exchange between the king of China, emperor of China, Emperor Wu, and Bodhidharma, who was the first teacher of Buddhism who came to China. Bodhidharma says, Emperor Wu, who's a devout Buddhist, he'd made temples and ordained many monks and was very, very, thought of himself as a scholar of Buddhism, was a scholar of Buddhism. He meets this master and he says to him, "Who are you facing me?" Same as Pilate did. "Who are you facing me?" And Bodhidharma says, "Don't know. Don't know." First principle. And then Emperor Wu says, "Oh, I'm sorry." His first question to Bodhidharma was, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" First principle. What is the highest meaning of the holy truths? He wants him to tell him. And Bodhidharma says, "Vast emptiness, nothing holy." Screensaver. Vast emptiness, nothing holy. Or completely full, everything holy. Either way, works fine. No place to spit. And then the emperor says, "Who are you facing me?" Bodhidharma says, "Don't know." First principle. Don't know. You'll never know. You can't say. So this is a wisdom teaching, and this is what we long to hear from all the traditions. We need to hear these teachings that liberate us from knowing, from being right, from having answers, from hating. We need to stop hating so we can get the work done. There's a lot of work to do here. A lot of hungry people. Questions or?
1, 2, 3. I'm going to break. Go ahead.
First of all, I want to say thank you for going to see the film. I have various friends who have gone to see the film. I have not been able to break myself, to be honest with you, to see the film. And I have some criticisms of myself for not being able to do it. But nevertheless, that is my position. So therefore, I'm very grateful and indebted to people who bring to me their experiences. And so I can hold that. One of my issues is
took me a long time. I also went to see Black Hawk Down for the same reason. I mean, what are we doing? I mean, what's happening? Or Day After Trinity about the first atomic bomb. And but I have to work up to it. I just don't kind of flip through these things. It's like, you know, how many real big hits can you take before you start to get numb? I think one of the interesting things about the film, as an experience for me anyway, was I thought Mr. Gibson is not a very good cinematographer because he doesn't really understand horror. He numbed me out, you know. Flail number 39, number 40, number 40. You know, after a while, I was going, okay. I mean, it went on for 11 film minutes, which is a long time. And at first, it was really awful. It was just horrific. But it really did get to be possible to look at. And because I was going, oh, God, no, they're not going to hit him with the, you know. First, they hit him with a stick, and then they took these things that had, you know, they were gouging flesh out of him, and I was like, oh, God, no, I can't believe it, you know. But then it went on and on and on. And I think it could have been a lot worse if he hadn't overdone it. Just one, even the first hint, the shadow. I was watching Nosferatu. I went down to Hollywood last week with my daughter. And did anyone know Robert Rigamonti? He goes down to Tosca. Anyway, he works for the Academy, and he took us in to watch these old silent film clips. And Nosferatu, the Murnau film, was part of what we were watching. And just the hint, the shadow of this thing coming to the room, I was like, oh, God, you know, it was so frightening. So, yeah. I totally understand. You have to watch out for numbing, maybe more than anything. Keep ourselves fresh for the reality that's behind the videos.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's hard for us to think about where we are right now in this country, where the other administration is, from my perspective, doing just kind of talking about what the audience is talking about. All these evils and these terrors who hate freedom and, you know, everyone's like, which religion is, and not very religion is, of course, Christianity, which is. This is something that I've this obsessive need, this war, this administration, and if you already step aside, you see like a very dualistic thing going on within me, where I'm thinking that all this evil is coming from the current administration.
It's not.
It is.
So
there's a variety of evil that just happens every day, but there's a special evil. I think special evil for me, my politics people have their view of it. It's coming from this administration and from people who support it. And I just wonder how you can respond to that, because I mean I almost feel something, well, okay, that's probably not the most likely view for you to have either. I'm not acknowledging, you know, my own shadow or the shadow of people around me who I love to support similar things. I see us going down this road of horror. I open newspapers, I see more 21-year-old men and women being slaughtered. And also on the other side, hundreds of civilians being slaughtered from this senseless, ugly war. I just get so outraged and upset, and I'm just so fooled by the sense of evil going from these people that are controlling our administration. Okay, guys, maybe you can respond to that.
It's world history. It's the begins with seeing things as outside, as other, and you know everyone. It's not like you're the only one seeing clearly. It's everyone is looking as at there's the other. If you externalize the other as an enemy, as a someone who's got something of yours, in any way you do that, whatever level you do that, and whatever kind of power you have to do that, Mr. Bush has a lot of power in his externalizations. Someone told me that, Colin Powell said to him, you break it, you bought it, about Iraq, you know. Jeez, that's quick, but... kind of like that. He's got the power to go into a big store and break it. And he's, you know, these guys are, it's bizarre how much they can do by agreeing to do it. You know, you don't have that kind of leverage yet. So when you get that kind of leverage, just don't forget, you know, what it means to be in a situation where you're actually being listened to by all those 20-year-olds. You know? And, but each one of them's responsible for their actions too. They don't get off the hook because they, you know, they're signing up. They want to go help America. Something like that. Yeah, sure,
okay,
of course.
Okay, we're running over.
It's a long story.
It's a long story. We have to stop. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
Okay, quickly, announcements. We have hosts. Jim and Carl.
We have Avalon Bakery treats outside. We'll have a Don Bowl out. $5 contribution is suggested. Please wash your teacups and take all your garbage so that we don't have critters running after our crumbs.
Donna.
The regular members got the newsletter, hopefully. I just have to say, I have tears when I look at, if I saw it today for the first time, I don't know why I didn't get one. And it just, it's so great. It's about, it's about the prisoners, about the Dharma practice of prisoners in prison, what they do. Then we'll get a little mailing party. Just send them their newsletters. If it's not really appreciated, just the people who help me.
It's a mailing party today.
The what?
We're
doing a special thing because we're doing something, sending them some extra stuff. So, yeah, so it should take long, especially planning things that way.
Hey.
Yeah, Paul is hosting a potluck by May 1st. And there's some flyers. And if anyone feels that they are pretty sure that they're going, aren't you still?
Yeah, I'll.
Okay, because he was just a little nervous about this, his first potluck. So if anyone felt like calling and saying, also if they could, you know, be there with him, I had originally said I would have been going to the retreat, so I'd back out. If someone
would.
It's in the newsletter for this Saturday. We're doing our famous annual Wildflower Hike at Chimney Rock GPF. It's an all-day event. It's a very long drive, but it's an incredibly beautiful drive, way up by the Point Reyes Lighthouse. But this, the event's described in the newsletter, but basically it's a potluck. We meet here at 9 o'clock, right outside for carpooling. It's a glorious place to go. And this season, it's like one of the best wildflower spots in Northern California. No guarantees. I mean, like, sometimes we'll go out across the
other side. The Sonoma County is just so green. And
yeah.
The flowers are, it's just spectacular this year.
Yeah, so it'll be fun. This is Saturday, 9 o'clock. Check your newsletter if you want.
Mark.
I am hosting a potluck in July, and I was thinking I'd like some feedback. I would like to have a cookout instead of a regular potluck. Because I've done lots of work in my backyard. I'm a show. So, but, you know, we can have edgy things and other things too, but, you know.
Like me.
It's a big
I really want to be there.
Great. What date is that?
July 10th.
Okay. And I was there, like, to my facilitation. We have some new people for the first time.
Yes.
And who else? So the first time, anyway, we have some people here who haven't been here for a long time.
Roger.
6 years. The question is why now? You know? Anyway, that's it. Happy spring, everyone, and let's get in a circle. And will you give us a blessing, please?
Gratitude for part company with each other today. This lovely rain, the spring, more flowers to come, and for the great love that can make us all grateful for this life.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.